He's Hacker.
Talk about a fried egg. I lasted about 5 minutes out there. I said, to heck with this. I'll do this in the morning. And I don't have any inside information. The lady that did it, she got in there.
I mean,
she made it happen.
And he doesn't shy away from opinion.
And I do enjoy drinking cold beer at ballparks. So if that makes me a baseball fan, then I'm a diehard baseball fan.
It's Hacker After Dark on 1010XL.
And a very good Monday evening to you, Jacksonville. It is Hacker After Dark, 1010XL, 92.5 FM with Dylan Denmark, the Hacker Ryan Green with you. Glad you are with us as we embark on another week. Boy, what a weekend it was. You had spring football in the world of college. You had a Masters champion, a repeat champion in Scottie Scheffler. And, oh, by the way, the NBA playoffs are now set, which includes my beloved Orlando Magic. We're going to talk about all of that. But first and foremost, after 99 long days, 99 days ago when the Jaguar season ended in Nashville with that loss to the Tennessee Titans, here we are 99 days later, and the Jaguars have come back for voluntary, quote-unquote voluntary, off-season workouts as that program began today down at the stadium. In fact, players will start meeting the media tomorrow. I'm excited about getting down on Thursday for the pre-draft luncheon from Trent Baalke and Doug Peterson. And, of course, we are 10 days away from the National Football League draft. So there is a ton to do. We are with you until 10 o'clock tonight. And we are glad you are with us. Guest lineup looks like this. John Shipley of Jaguar Report. Less than 20 minutes away as we'll take a look back on the offseason that was and the draft that will be next week. We mentioned the NBA playoffs. Keith Smith of the NBA Front Office Show and Spot Track will join me right about 9 o'clock as we'll preview the series, take a good hard look at Orlando, Miami, and the rest of the Eastern Conference. The playoffs begin tomorrow. The Western Conference play-in is tomorrow. Sacramento and Golden State, that's a win-or-go-home game. The Lakers and the Pelicans. Wednesday night is the Eastern play-in. Friday, you got do-or-die elimination games in both conferences. And then beginning Saturday, the NBA playoffs will start in full. So a lot to talk about in the association. Keith Smith of the NBA Front Office Show will stop by towards the top of the 9 o'clock hour. But as we do every night to kick it off here on Hacker After Dark, we give you a big deal of the night and Dylan Denmark. Let's do that right now.
Time now for the big deal of the night.
What's the big deal?
What is the big deal?
No big deal.
It is a big deal.
On Hacker After Dark.
So, 99 days ago, the Jacksonville Jaguars season came to an end. It was an unfortunate ending to the year, the loss in Nashville, capping off 5 out of 6, one of the biggest collapses, probably the biggest late-season collapse in NFL, or at least in Jaguar history. Maybe not NFL history, but certainly in Jaguar history. And now here we are, 99 days later, and the Jaguars report back for voluntary workouts. And I saw some of the guys rolling in, Jaguars.com, Jaguars social media was putting out some things, Trevor Lawrence, Gabe Davis among them. And look, this kind of starts the season, right? They had 3 months off, 14 weeks off, and now here we are. The voluntary work begins, team meetings begin, work in the weight room officially begins. OTAs are next month. The draft is next week. So because the guys are back for voluntary work, I thought it would be an interesting exercise to kind of look back on the NFL offseason here in Jacksonville and everything that transpired over the last 99 days. And you tend to forget some things, right? Because there was a lot that transpired. There was a lot that was on our plate. It really started with that loss in Nashville, and the very next day, Mike Caldwell, the defensive coordinator, was fired along with 10 assistant coaches, all let go. 11 coaches in total off the staff in less than 24 hours after the season came to an end. Pretty surprising, but it was a quick start to the offseason. You then go to the hire of Ryan Nielsen as Jaguar defensive coordinator from the Atlanta Falcons, a guy that was well-respected, is well-respected, a guy that was interviewed by other NFL teams. Certainly, he looks like a guy that could potentially be a good hire here in Jacksonville. So Mike Caldwell out, Ryan Nielsen in for the Jaguars. You then look at the NFL free agency that transpired and the guys that have been here for a couple of years that were shown the door, from Foley Fatakasi, who's gone, to Rayshon Jenkins, who's gone. You look at guys like Darius Williams, who's gone. A lot of guys were released leading up to free agency. A lot of guys were extended. Brandon Sheriff was extended. Ezra Cleveland was extended. You look at a guy, situations like the Jaguars had, not only with Ezra Cleveland, not only with Brandon Sheriff, but other guys like Foye Oluokun, who got a brand new contract. So a lot of contracts were reworked to give the Jaguars some extra room. And then the Jaguars were one of the most active teams in free agency, from Mitch Morse to Gabe Davis, Ronald Darby to Darnell Savage, Joey Sly to Trevis Gibson, the trading for Mac Jones, bringing back a Jacksonville kid here to the Jaguars to back up Trevor Lawrence. They added a lot in free agency, with the biggest haul being Eric Armstead. And, of course, the biggest disappointment being Calvin Ridley going to the Tennessee Titans. So you take all of that, you bundle that up, and you take all of that, and you're like, wow, there has been a ton that has transpired. And that doesn't even bring into account the extension for Josh Allen, who was a franchise tag player. He got a mega contract, and Josh Allen is now back in Jacksonville on a 5-year extension. So the Jaguars right now, to me, 99 days after the season ended on January 7th, reporting for voluntary workouts, to me, the Jaguars are a better football team in many areas. To me, they're better on the offensive line. To me, they're better on the defensive line. To me, they're every bit as good at secondary. To me, you look at the return position, Jamal Agnew out, Devin Duvernay in, a former All-Pro, a former Pro Bowler. I'm fine with that. There has been a lot of change. There has been a lot of turnover in the last 99 days, but I think most of it is for the better. Better backup quarterback. Mac Jones, to me, is an upgrade over C.J. Beathard. The question remains, what about the skill position players around Trevor Lawrence? Calvin Ridley out, Gabe Davis in. Christian Kirk is healthy. Zay Jones is still in the mix. Of course, Evan Engram, Travis Etienne. And then you got guys that you hope can take a step up, like a Parker Washington, like a Brenton Strange, like a Tank Bigsby. How big will their leap be from year one to year two? Well, in the instance of Bigsby and Strange, you hope it's pretty dramatic. They had underwhelming rookie years. Hopefully they improve in year number two. But the question is there enough talent on this team to do something moving forward? You look at what Houston did. They are vastly better than they were in January. When you add Danielle Hunter, when you add Joe Mixon, when you add Stephon Diggs, when you add DeNico Autry, there is no question the Titans are better with L'Jarius Sneed and Calvin Ridley and Tony Pollard and Cushenberry, the center. It was an overhaul in the AFC South, man. A lot of things transpired. It has gone from a division that was awful, an embarrassment, one of the worst divisions in football, to now one of the most intriguing, dare I say, one of the best divisions in football, because I think you could argue that all four teams, as we sit here in the middle part of April, probably feel they got a pretty good shot of winning this division when the season rolls around in September. And it all leads, the last 99 days, all lead to next Thursday night and the NFL draft, the Jaguars with pick 17. Will it be a wide receiver like Brian Thomas or A.D. Mitchell? Will it be a corner like Terrion Arnold or Quinyon Mitchell? Or will it be a best available player situation like I've been slamming my hand down night after night here on Hacker After Dark? If Jared Verse is there, that is my guy at 17. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. So it's been a very interesting offseason. again, it's going to continue. The roster will look different a week and a half from now than it does tonight. But it is interesting. 99 days after the season ended, the Jaguars are back for voluntary work. And you look at what they've done in the last 99 days, and it has been an overhaul of the Jaguar roster. Of the 53 guys that will suit up in September, I would say 15 to 20 were probably not here in 2023. And when 20 new guys out of your 53 are going to be on the roster, it has been an overhaul of an offseason for the Jacksonville Jaguars. 641-1010 is the phone number on the phone line and on the text line. Designed by Lifetime Enclosures. Not only a lot of NFL news tonight. Again, John Shipley of Jaguar Report is less than 10 minutes away. We had an orange and blue spring game down in Gainesville on Saturday. Reported 48,000 people down in Gainesville. Good for them. Not a lot of expectations for Billy Napier and the Gators coming into the year, but to get 48,000 for a spring game, that was pretty good. Everybody wanted to see DJ Lagway. I thought DJ Lagway put on a show as much as you can for wearing a non-contact jersey and what is basically a glorified scrimmage. I thought Ball, the freshman running back, the former Arkansas commit, looked very good. Obviously, you got some nice plays from Trey Wilson. Look, the Gators have talent. There's no question about that. It's a lot of young talent, but the talent is there. The schedule to me is just very, very daunting. And I thought Chris Doering and the folks on the ESPN Plus broadcast, they kind of laid it out pretty good, right? They laid out the legit expectations for Florida. And I thought Doering brought up a great point. You know, people were talking about the non-conference. I'm one of them. Florida State, UCF, Miami. Well, Florida's always talked about they're the best team in the state of Florida, right? Well, we're going to find out. We're going to find out in 2024, and it begins opening night, August 31st against Miami. About a month later, you have UCF, and then obviously at the end of the year, Florida State. So all that talk that Florida fans like to do about being the best football program in the state of Florida, there's going to be a round robin for them with three in-state schools on their schedule, and we're going to find out pretty quick if Florida is still the class of the state. Didn't see a lot of the other spring games. I did see Ohio State had 80,000 people at their spring game. 80,000 for the Buckeyes. Unbelievably impressive. Say what you will about Ohio State, but that fan base is ridiculously loyal to pack 80 grand into the horseshoe for nothing more than a glorified scrimmage. So we'll talk a lot about the orange and blue game later in the week. The Garnet and Gold game in Tallahassee comes up on Saturday. Ira Schoffel of warchant.com will join us later in the week to preview the Florida State side of things as Mike Norvell and the Seminoles wrap up their spring on Saturday. Caitlin Clark has been the first overall pick in the WNBA draft. I can safely say, without a shadow of a doubt, this is the first time that I've ever updated you on the WNBA draft, but that's what Caitlin Clark is going to do for this league. It's interesting how much more popular women's college basketball is than the WNBA, and it's been that way for quite some time. But I do think Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, all these college stars that are getting drafted tonight in the WNBA will cause a little bit of intrigue, right? I mean, Caitlin Clark did a cameo on Saturday Night Live this past week. I actually thought she was pretty funny. Thought she did a pretty good job in the skit that she was involved with. So she is the number one pick. I saw the Indiana Fever, who took her, had like thousands of people at their watch party tonight. So they're all sorts of fired up. Caitlin Clark goes number one. And, of course, the Masters, as we mentioned off the top, did not have the suspense at the end, did not have the great finish at the end. To me, yesterday, Scottie Scheffler's dominance and Vern Lundquist were the big stories. Sad to see Vern go, but man alive, 40 Masters, including the last 25 where he's been on 16, calling the action. Seeing Tiger Woods go find Vern Lundquist yesterday and embrace him at the 16th green, that was cool, man. That is what sports is all about. That is what the Masters is all about. And then to Scottie Scheffler, Denmark, I know you follow golf a lot more than I do, but man alive, this dude is just a machine right now. He becomes the second person ever to win a Players and a Masters in the same year, joining Tiger Woods, who I believe did it in 2001. Scottie Scheffler, if he didn't have a Hall of Fame career before this year, he's had a Hall of Fame career already, and he's just getting started, it appears.
Yeah, Saturday was like four or five guys tied for the lead when Scottie was at the ninth hole, and then he hits a double, and then he hits a bogey back-to-back, and you're like, oh, we might have something, and then he eagles 14. And then the same thing happened yesterday. Four or five guys tied for the league, and then Scottie just separates it. You know when you're really good at your sport, the top 1%, whenever everybody else is really good, and you separate like that.
Well, and the thing, too, again, not that I'm a savant when it comes to the world of golf, but any time yesterday somebody pulled within a shot or two, it was within the next hole that Scottie Scheffler just made a ridiculous approach shot, tapped it in for a birdie or whatever to go back up two or go back up three. Guys tried to make runs at him, Denmark, but he fended them off every step of the way.
Yeah, and when there was a lot of times where like Bryson DeChambeau or somebody overshot the green, or those greens were playing really, really tough, and it didn't seem that tough for Scottie, like at all. The whole four rounds. I watched most of the weekend. It didn't look it tough at all for him on the weekend.
As a guy that likes that back nine at Augusta, I would have liked to see more suspense, more question as to who was going to win. But with that being said, you have to appreciate the dominance of Scottie Scheffler, and that is exactly what we saw at Augusta National. So congratulations to him. And again, congratulations to maybe my favorite broadcaster. If I did a Mount Rushmore of my favorite broadcasters of all time, TV or radio, I think Vern Lundquist is probably on there. Going back, I mean, you know, obviously he had a great career before this with Jack Nicklaus in 86 and Christian Laettner in 92. But I watched 62-7 Jacksonville over Miami in the playoffs about 1,000 times in my teenage years, and Vern Lundquist was on the call of that game with Dan Dierdorf. So that's where my love for Vern Lundquist started about 25 or so years ago. And then obviously when he got the SEC gig on CBS, that was right into my wheelhouse. And I just think he does a magnificent job, and he will sorely be missed there at Augusta National. 641-1010 on the phone line and on the text line, designed by Lifetime Enclosures. The Jaguars are back to work 99 days after the season ended. The voluntary workout program began today, day number one. They're going to meet the media tomorrow. The pre-draft media luncheon is on Thursday. And, of course, the NFL draft, 10 nights from tonight, next Thursday, April the 25th. Let's talk Jags, let's talk offseason, and let's look ahead to next week with John Shipley of Jaguar Report. He comes up next on a Monday night edition of Hacker After Dark, right here in the city of Jacksonville. We're glad you're with us. It's 1010XL, and it's 92.5 FM.
Let's ring up another guest on the All-Pro Roofing phone line.
Back here on 1010XL and 92.5 FM in the city of Jacksonville, we are glad you are with us. And just like that, the off-season, well, it's kind of over, right? The off-season workout program began today as the Jaguar players, the voluntary part of it, began reporting back. The draft is next week, and OTAs is a little over a month from right now. With that, John Shipley of Jaguar Report, always kind enough to join us here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. John, how we doing?
Hey, doing good, my friend. How you doing?
John, we're good. All right, it's voluntary, but the boys are back, at least most of them. Your thoughts, man, as we begin here in totality, kind of the last 100 days, the offseason that was. What are your thoughts now on the roster now that the guys are coming back in for voluntary workouts?
Yeah, no, there's still, you know, obviously a couple aspects of the roster that still have to be touched up, which is, you know, always the case in April. It's one of the big things that always kind of makes me laugh is when people talk pre-draft, like rosters are finalized and stuff like that. No, there's a lot that can change in the next, you know, several months, especially in the next 2 weeks. I think the Jaguars overall are probably very happy with their offseason. They've retained some of the key guys that they wanted to. Josh Allen, Ezra Cleveland, Brandon Sheriff still around, Cam Robinson still around. Those two guys that they clearly wanted to keep around as opposed to releasing for, you know, cap space. They brought in several guys, Eric Armstead, Mitch Morse, Gabe Davis, Darnell Savage, Ronald Darby. Devin Duvernay. I feel like, you know, they've had overall a solid offseason, especially on the heels of the Josh Allen extension, which is, you know, one of the bigger momentous occasions that they've had offseason-wise in quite some time.
And speak to that. You and I haven't talked since the Josh Allen extension last week. Obviously a monster deal, 5 years, could be upwards of 100 and what, $30+ million, or even more, $88 million of that is guaranteed. Your thoughts on Josh Allen now being here for the long haul?
Well, I think obviously it's a good thing, you know, for the franchise, for Josh Allen, for I think the fan base. I think that, you know, the best teams in the NFL are the ones that develop and keep their own talent. And the Jaguars just haven't done that very much in the last, you know, decade and a half or so. Since 2010, you know, only 3 first-round picks have signed extensions. Now, obviously, the counter-argument to that is how many first-round picks that they had worth extending. Well, you can go beyond that. You know, if you include the second and third round over the last 14 years, only 6 more players, you know, on top of that original 3 have signed extensions in the first 3 rounds. So the Jaguars have had some really good football players come through Jacksonville, you know, Jalen Ramsey, Yannick Ngakoue, Allen Robinson, but they haven't been able to keep very many of them, you know, very many young cornerstone guys. There's a reason why they've had to supplement in free agency so often, why for so many years their best players have been players they signed in March instead of drafted in April. I think signing Josh Allen goes a long way towards fixing that, because you're saying to the rest of the locker room, you know, we're going to invest in you both in the draft and when the time comes to pay you, as long as you're doing the right things on and off the field and producing like Josh Allen obviously did and has.
John Shipley of Jaguar Report. All right, the draft is next week. Let's look at the roster now and get your thoughts on where they may go. The two positions everybody's talking about is wide receiver and defensive back. Let's begin, John, at wide receiver. With the assumption that Christian Kirk, Gabe Davis, Zay Jones are your top 3, you sprinkle in Parker Washington, Devin Duvernay, I guess, deserves to be mentioned there. Do you believe at 17 – wide receiver was definitely in play for the Jaguars?
I'm not sure it'd be in play at 17. I really think that, you know, they'd be interested in one of the top 3 receiver prospects, Marvin Harrison Jr., Rome Odunze, and Malik Nabers. I'm not as sold that they'd be all in on some of the other guys that you see frequently mocked at 17, such as Brian Thomas Jr. or Adonai Mitchell. I have a hard time believing that the Jaguars will see the 2 of them as, you know, one of the 17 best players in the class. I think it's just more likely that they either trade up for a receiver or they wait on one, say in the second or third round, as opposed to taking one at 17, because just the way this draft class falls, you know, like there are 3 receivers who should go in the top 10, probably a dozen or so who should go in the top 50 to 60. But in that 17 range, it's just, there's not very many unless you're completely sold on Thomas and Mitchell.
It's interesting that you say that, and I like that opinion because that's not one that I've heard very often. So you're not, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to me, it doesn't seem like you're sold on either A.D. Mitchell or Brian Thomas.
No, if I was the one making the decision, I wouldn't pick either one of those players at 17. They're obviously very high upside, but I think if you just look at this receiver class in general and receiver classes in the past few years in general, you don't need to force a receiver pick in the first round. You know, you can find productive receivers elsewhere. Now, obviously, if you believe that guy can be a bona fide number 1 and a future star, you should take him. But otherwise, you know, if there's some middle ground there, if there's still some projection involved, I think you're better off value-wise waiting. Now, that doesn't include guys like those big 3 I mentioned and Harrison, Nabers, and Odunze, because I think they're just on a different stratosphere as prospects. They can enter the NFL and be kind of, you know, set it and forget it, you know, 1,000-yard type guys right away. I'm not sure there's another guy like that in this class. So to me, it just makes more sense from an efficiency and a market standpoint to wait, you know, maybe until 48 or 96 for that receiver if you're not taking one of the truly elite guys.
You're seeing more mock drafts out there nationally that have the Jaguars trading up for Odunze out of Washington. What do you think the realistic chances are that Trent Baalke were to pull something like that off next week?
I wouldn't put it at 0%. I think that the Jaguars and Baalke are probably aware that they still need to take another big swing somewhere this offseason, you know, just to keep pace with the Houston Texans and obviously what the Titans have done this offseason. Obviously, the Colts have kept a lot of their guys, so it wouldn't surprise me to see him make an aggressive move up. haven't seen him make as like really any move like that before, other than if you maybe count the trade up for Devin Lloyd. But I do think that he could see this specific class, these specific prospects, this specific, you know, year and construction of the roster and say, okay, we need one of these number one guys. We can't afford to take a guy at 48 or take a guy even at 17 and develop and hope he turns into a number one 3 or 4 years down the road.
Couple of more for John Shipley of Jaguar Report. Same question about the cornerback room. The thought is Tyson Campbell, Ronald Darby, Darnell Savage, apparently are your top three guys right now. Everybody's talking about Arnold from Alabama, Quinyon Mitchell from Toledo. Now, if one of those guys is there, it might be a no-brainer. I guess my question, John, if both guys are gone, could the Jaguars or should the Jaguars still go corner at 17?
I think there's a good chance if those two guys are gone that if you want to go truly best player available, the best player available might be an offensive lineman as opposed to a cornerback. I think corner is a lot like the receiver class this year outside of having, you know, three top 10 guys. I think this corner class has 4 to 5 guys who are solid first round picks. And then there are several other guys that you could take at 48 and not blink. Max Melton, from Rutgers, I think, you know, I don't think he's far off from some of the top cornerbacks in this class. If you can get him at 48 and pair him with another player at 17, that could be maximizing what you do on the back end. So it wouldn't surprise me if some of these top guys are off the board at 17. You know, I think the Colts make a lot of sense to take a corner. I could see the Broncos taking a corner. The Raiders have been linked to Terrion Arnold a good bit. I could see that being a scenario where, you know, it's just the guys they would consider are gone, so they have to pivot elsewhere.
You mentioned offensive tackle, and I like that because people always seem to think the draft is a one-year proposition. No, the draft in theory is supposed to be a 10-year proposition with your first-round pick. Of course, that hasn't applied here in Jacksonville very often. And you look after the 24 season, and I know you know this, John, but for people that don't, Cam Robinson's a free agent, Walker Little's a free agent. So even though you have depth, you would think, at that position this year, that depth could be very easily ruptured after this year. So offensive tackle at 17 might make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I really think that when you look at the potential of taking an offensive lineman, the first pick, first of all, you have to consider the fact that what are the odds the Jaguars go through 17 games with all 5 of their offensive linemen healthy? I mean, last year we saw how their offensive line, especially the left side, got ravaged by injuries. Chances are, even if a guy starts week 1 as a backup, he's probably starting at some point in the season. And then once he does start, there's a good chance he's not coming, you know, out of the lineup. And it's just, this is such a deep offensive line class. There are so many guys who can play inside out, guys who can play both tackle positions. It wouldn't surprise me if they, you know, say a couple of these corners off the board at 17, they say, we just have to take the best player. And, you know, if you take a versatile offensive lineman who can start multiple positions at a near Pro Bowl level for a decade, that's a heck of a first round pick. And, you know, people love to question, you know, offensive lines and, you know, really what teams are getting out of them, but they hate it when you invest in them. So eventually, you know, you have to figure out what you want. You either want to invest in an offensive line or you want it to remain stagnant. So it wouldn't surprise me in the least that that's the first pick, even if he might not start week 1.
I like the idea of an offensive lineman. Now, I'll tell you this, and my caveat the entire offseason leading up to the draft has been wide receiver, DB, offensive line. I can hear you on all three arguments. I didn't think there was a prayer this guy would be here at 17. And truthfully, I'm still probably against him being there at 17. But the more mock drafts that you see coming out, John, the more times than not Jared Verse is there at 17. And I got to tell you, man, if Verse is there at 17 next Thursday, and I have the idea of Trayvon Walker, Josh Allen, Eric Armstead, and Jared Verse on my defensive line, I might sprint to the podium. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, it certainly wouldn't surprise me. And again, you know, best player available type scenario. I think there's a better chance that Jared Verse is the best player available than there is Brian Thomas or Donnie Mitchell being B. I, you know, just think that he's, you know, a ready-made pass rusher. You know, he wins a lot in the ways that Trent Baalke has seemingly, you know, wanted edge guys to win. You know, he's a real speed-to-power type guy. He plays the run really well. He's been an ascending prospect for the last couple of years after going, you know, to Albany College and then finally coming to FSU and producing for the last 2 years. Me personally, I don't think it's ever a bad idea to take an edge rusher. Even if you're stacked, you know, I think you know, maybe the Jets taking Will McDonald last year to be their number five edge in the first round is probably where I would draw the line. But if you're taking a guy to be your number three edge and you're also open to moving a guy like Trayvon around, I think it would make a lot of sense.
Final moments with John Shipley of Jaguar Report. And look, they have the 17th pick next Thursday, but those other four picks right after that, 48, 96, and even 114 and 116, five picks in the top 116. John, they have to hit on those, right? I think Balky's done a good job in round one. His second and third rounders have been almost horrible as of late. Now, the jury's still out on a lot of those guys, but they certainly have not gotten off to great starts. That has to change. You got to not only hit on 17, but I think you got to hit on 48, 96, and maybe one or both of those early fourth rounders.
Oh, absolutely. You need to get more of a rookie impact than you had gotten a year ago, because it's obvious the roster isn't as flawless that they thought it was a year ago when they took a backup running back and backup tight end on day two. That's been their biggest issue, I think, you know, during the Balky era has been the day two picks. I mean, you know, Luke Fortner and Chad Muma in 2022, obviously, you know, Tank Bigsby and Brendan Strange last year. Even if you go back, you know, to 2021, Walker Little and Andre Sisco produced eventually, but certainly not as rookies. So they really have 3 years now where, you know, their entire second and third rounds have kind of been wasted years as rookies. I don't think they can do that again.
All right, John, as we begin to wrap up, you said you don't think the Jaguars – well, I'm paraphrasing here, not to put words in your mouth, but it didn't seem like that you thought they were done at wide receiver, at least taking a big swing, I think is how you phrased it. So do you buy the idea that now that they have that added cap room after the Josh Allen deal – that maybe whether it's Ayuk, T. Higgins, somebody we're not even talking about, could they make a swing for a wide receiver that could help this team in 2024?
No, I really don't think that there's a veteran route that's plausible. The Brandon Ayuk stuff, in my opinion, has completely jumped the shark. I mean, we saw his agent come out yesterday and say that he hasn't requested a trade just because the nature of social media that we're in now, you have every, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry claiming to have sources, and people just run with it. I don't think Brandon Ayuk's going to get traded. I think it's going to be just like Debo was with them, where he's frustrated for a bit and then eventually hammers out a deal. And then T. Higgins himself even admitted that he doesn't think he's getting traded. And, you know, I was in the 1010 studio last week and I said the same thing. I don't think T. Higgins is going to get traded. I think the Bengals are going to simply shrug off his trade request like they did with Jesse Bates a few years ago and hope that he, you know, is obviously on the field this fall as they aim for a Super Bowl, you know, window. So I don't think either of those two guys are going to get traded. So I think the cap space is, it's good to have. They like entering the season with cap space because it gives you the flexibility to make, you know, a big move, especially near the deadline. So I think they'll keep their eyes open. I just don't see either of those two receivers being moved. I really think both situations have kind of jumped the shark in fans' eyes.
All right, final question. Next Thursday, pick 17, assuming the Jaguars remain there. It sounds like you want to go offensive tackle. Do you have a guy in mind at 17?
Man, it's tough. I really think a guy like Amarius Mims would make a lot of sense. I think he can play inside. I think he can play, obviously, right tackle at a high level. Troy Fautanu, though, from Washington, I think would probably be a dream pick for them because, I mean, I've heard from people who think he can be a Pro Bowl center, you know, let alone a starting NFL tackle or a starting NFL guard. Like, he can legitimately be a potential guy who can play all five positions along the offensive line. I think taking a guy like that would, you know, obviously do wonders for them moving down the road as they figure out this offensive line depth chart.
John, tell us about Jaguar Report and the Jaguar Report podcast that you guys have.
Yeah, you can find us at Jaguar Report, SI.com/NFL/Jaguars. We'll be having some more updates on everything we're doing, you know, in the coming weeks, but I'm still doing Jaguar Report podcast with Gus Logue. We had taken a few weeks hiatus, but we came back this week to talk the Josh Allen contract, and we'll talk again, you know, a few times ahead of the draft and then obviously after the draft to give our thoughts.
John Shipley of Jaguar Report. John, I know you're busy, man. Thank you for the time. Let's do it again after the draft. We'll see where the dust has settled with the Jaguars.
I'll be there, my friend.
Hacker After Dark on 1010XL.
Yes, it is. Glad you're with us on a Monday night. 13 minutes before the 9 o'clock hour. We'll take you all the way up to 10 o'clock. 92.5 FM, 1010 XL, 8 to 10 every evening, except tomorrow, which we're actually in for Blue. We'll be on 6 to 8 tomorrow night on a Tuesday. Denmark, you and I have been working together now for over 2 years, and you knew me before we started working together every night. I've done my best as I've gotten older, more seasoned, a little wiser, not only in age and life and experience, but obviously here in sports radio as a host. I've done my best to not just say something to get a rise out of people. There may have been a time back in the day where I would say something to try to start issues with people, and I've learned my lessons from that. I've grown from that. I've matured from that. And now I consider myself to be that objective broadcast journalist, the oldest 40-year-old in Jacksonville. We know everything that I say. But something struck me today, and don't get me wrong, I don't dislike this, but I'm not over the moon about it either, and I'm genuinely curious why I'm seemingly the outcast here, where I don't have an opinion on it one way or the other. The Jaguars announced they're bringing back their throwback uniforms, turning back the clock, right? Which, okay, I'm fine with. I don't have any issue with it. But man, the confetti that was raining down on social media this morning from people, not only locally, but nationally. Kay Adams did a whole thing about the Jaguar uniforms coming back from the 90s. I had Jaguar uniforms. I bought jerseys from 95 up till when I got hired in sports radio in 2002. I bought my son Jaguar jerseys through the years, the last 4 or 5 years. Again, I don't dislike the throwbacks. I think they're fine, but I thought the uniforms they had now were fine. I think I just care too much about the team winning, because the Jaguars winning just cures everything.
Here's the question.
Honestly, hold on. I don't care if they go out there dressed like Bozo the Clown. They could go out there as Chippendales actors. I could care less. Get me a W on Sunday so that I have something victorious to talk about during the fifth quarter, and I'm happy as a pig in mud. I don't need throwbacks. I don't need new uniforms. If it happens, so be it. But man alive, people were over the moon this morning about that announcement.
Yeah, I understand why you don't care. Like, you're of the older person, which I know a lot of people, like, you know, of your age or older, like, don't care. I understand that. But do you understand why some people care about it? Like, do you understand why they get hyped up about it, or you're like, I still understand it?
I mean, the one thing I guess is it brings you back to times gone by when the Jaguars were a well-run, good organization in the days of Mark Brunell and Fred Taylor and Tony Boselli and Jimmy Smith and Keenan McCardell. So I loved those Jaguar uniforms, but I loved them because the guys that were wearing them in the mid-90s or late 90s were winning football games, were winning division championships, went to 2 AFC championship games in 4 years. Is that why? I mean, they're liked so much? But you mentioned the older crowd. You would have to be older to remember that. You were not alive for most of that. Why does the young crowd want these throwbacks so bad?
Because they look better than what they have now, I think. And it's the nostalgia. Like you said, it's the 90s. It was... The uniforms were better in the 90s with that Jaguar logo on the shoulder than they are now.
Yeah, the Jaguar logo on the shoulder, I guess, did it for me a little bit now that you mention it. But honestly, when I'm watching a game on Sunday and they're playing the Tennessee Titans, man, do I really take a step out and say, man, they'd look better if a Jaguar was on the shoulder? I guess I just never have thought about that or contemplated that. I don't know. Maybe I'm in the minority, at least for the people I saw on social media. And again, don't misread or don't misinterpret what I'm saying. Oh, Hacker's against the throwbacks. I'm not against the throwbacks. If they want to wear throwbacks, fine. That's awesome. You know, whatever makes the fan base happy, and it obviously makes the fan base happy. But when I saw the announcement, it really did not affect me, as obviously it affected a lot of other people in a very positive way.
So they wear throwbacks. Would you rather them go all black or the teal? Like, what was your favorite uniform from the 90s?
They didn't,
like, if they had to pick one game.
Yeah, they didn't really wear – they didn't wear black at all in the 90s. They didn't bring the black uniforms or black pants till the early to mid-2000s, if not later than that. To me, I'm a traditional guy. Like, the whole Florida thing, I'll compare it to the Gators. There was a time there where Florida was getting ridiculous with their uniforms. I'm a meat and potatoes guy. Give me the blue jersey and the white pants, all right? I don't need blue jerseys and orange pants or orange jerseys and blue pants. I thought that looked ridiculous.
Those blue jerseys and orange pants do look pretty good, though.
Oh, God, I thought it was awful. I thought it was awful. They wore that 99 against Florida State and got the crap beat out of them.
So
that's
they lost. What I remember. That's why you don't like them.
Well, that's what I remember about the blue jerseys and the orange pants. But no, again, for the Jaguars, they have more. They probably have more uniform combinations, honestly, than any team in the league. Because if think about it, they have a black jersey, a white jersey, and a teal jersey. They got black pants, teal pants, and white pants. So you got minimum six different combinations you could wear. Is there any other team that has minimum six different combinations they could wear?
No, unless they go to the throwbacks like the Patriots do every now and then.
Right. I mean, I think Jacksonville already had an unbelievable variety, almost maybe too much. And the throwbacks, like I said, man, the fan base is excited. Hey, whatever gets the fan base fired up, all right? And it obviously got them fired up. And I couldn't think of anything good to say about the post on social media that the Jaguars sent out earlier. So I just went to the Big Lebowski GIF and put the cowboy saying thank you while he's drinking his beer at the end of the movie. Because I figured I had to say something. Everybody was commenting on it. I didn't want to be left out in the cold. But again, in thinking about it all day, I mean, it's all right. Don't get me wrong. I'm fine with it. But a lot of people fired up. But, hey, man, to each his own. Whatever fires you up about Jaguar football, that's great. Like I said, give me W's. Wear whatever the hell you want. Throwbacks, new uniforms, sleeveless, be like Rick Wild Thing Vaughn. I don't care what you do. Just win games on Sunday and bring a winning product to Duval County and here in Jacksonville, Florida. NBA teams have brought winning products to their fan bases this offseason. And the Orlando Magic are one of them for the first time in 4 years. Orlando punches their ticket to the playoffs yesterday with a win over Milwaukee. The playoffs really begin tomorrow night. Tomorrow night's kind of funny. You got the Western Conference play-in games. You got the Lakers and the Pelicans. The winner of that game gets Denver in round one, the defending world champions. They'll never say it publicly, but I bet behind closed doors, the Lakers and the Pelicans both wish they lose tomorrow night. Now, granted, if they lose, then they're in a win-or-go-home scenario on Friday. But a loss tomorrow night, you avoid Denver. A win tomorrow night, you have to play Denver in round one, which probably would not work out well for either team. But the Knicks get the 2 seed in the East. They will get the winner of Miami and Philadelphia, which is the East play-in on Wednesday. A lot of intriguing matchups. Orlando gets Cleveland. I didn't realize this. It's only the second time ever Orlando and Cleveland have played in the playoffs. The first time was in the Eastern Conference Finals back in 2009. That was the year Orlando upset Cleveland in 6, yet all anybody wants to talk about is the LeBron James buzzer beater in Game 2. I remember I was on with Frangie and Baloo. Golly, that was 15 years ago. Talk about making me feel old. 15 years ago, and all anybody was doing, this was back when we actually took calls, Denmark, on the radio station, long, long time ago. Oh, it was LeBron this and Cleveland that. And I told him, Orlando's going to beat Cleveland. Orlando's better than them. Orlando dominated them in the regular season. And I was the young and dumb 24-year-old by everybody's viewpoint going into that series. And Orlando wiped the floor with him. Should have beat him in 5 if LeBron didn't pull that 30-footer at the buzzer out of his hat. But nevertheless, this will be the second meeting in a playoff series ever between Orlando and Cleveland. That is the 4-5 in the East. Let's talk about all of it. Orlando, the Eastern playoffs, the Western playoffs with Keith Smith. He is the host of the NBA Front Office Show. You also check out his work at SpotTrack. Big-time NBA guy, is a valuable resource when it comes to NBA. And let's talk about the playoffs and the Magic next. Hacker After Dark on a Monday night. Hey, celebrate the throwback uniforms, man. I'm here for it. Whatever makes you happy. I hope you're happy listening to Hacker After Dark right here on 1010XL and 92.5 FM.
Yeah, I'm pumped.
Back here on 1010XL and 92.5 FM in the city of Jacksonville, we are glad you are with us. The NBA playoffs begin, well, really tomorrow night. The two Western Conference play-ins on Wednesday, the two Eastern Conference play-ins, and once all the dust is settled on Saturday, there will be 16 teams remaining for the NBA World Championship. With that, Keith Smith does a great job covering the NBA for both Spot Track and the Front Office Show, and he's always kind enough to join us here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Keith, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Keith, I know you're busy, man. We certainly appreciate the time. It's certainly your time of year. And let's begin with Orlando, Keith. You and I talked about a month ago. At that point, it was looking good for the Magic, and they sputtered a little bit down the stretch. But man alive, in a really a must-win situation yesterday, they put it on Milwaukee, and Milwaukee was trying. That was everybody out there minus Giannis. What a win for the Magic, and they secure the fifth seed in the Eastern Conference playoffs.
Yeah, this was a great step forward season for the Magic. They bottomed it out after the, you know, couple of playoff years. Front office that had come in, kind of inherited those players, said, yeah, but there's a ceiling on these guys. They knew they weren't ever probably going to get deep in the playoffs. So they bottomed it out, made really good draft picks several years in a row, guys like Franz Wagner and Jalen Suggs, then with Paolo Banchero, and then added pieces around those guys that made sense. Now you step forward. Had they even not necessarily made the full run into the short playoff spot, still would have been a good year, but clinching that five seed, winning the division, that turns what was a really nice step forward year into a really good year with potentially more to come.
Keith, I understand nationally Orlando doesn't get the coverage or the love that maybe some fans, myself included, believe they're probably due. But having said that, Jamal Mosley, and I get that he's not going to win Coach of the Year, but the job he's done, he was rewarded with a brand new extension. What can you say about that man going from 22 wins in year one to 34 wins and now 47 wins, doubling the win total in just two calendar years?
Yeah, I'm going to use a word that Magic President of Basketball Operations Jeff Weltman considers to be kind of a taboo or dirty word, which is culture, because his feeling is good teams have good culture, bad teams generally don't. But I really think Jamal Mosley did come in and help change the culture somewhat. What he did was he came in and basically told these guys, hey, we're going to work really, really hard. We may not always be the most talented team. We may not be the flashiest team or the best shooting team, but we're going to work really hard. You're going to play the right way. And if you don't, you're just not going to play. And he's held to that, you know, through the last couple of seasons as this team has really started to improve. And that's important because sometimes what we see coaches do is they come in and they're all rah, rah, we're going to do this and that. And then when the team gets better, they start to fall out of some of those things. And it's, well, you know, we're not in that same place. He stuck to that all along. It's been the guys who are playing the right way are going to play. You can see it when you watch this team play night to night. You'll see, weird, if you just look at the box score, why wasn't this guy, why did he only play 15 minutes tonight instead of his normal 25 or 30? But if you watch the game, you'd see, well, he wasn't playing well. He had turnovers. He wasn't where he's supposed to be defensively. And that's been absolutely huge. And I think as the talent has improved, he's also improved as a coach, which is generally a pattern we like to see, you know, for younger first-time coaches as well. So great year for him. He should get lots of Coach of the Year love. We'll see if he wins it or not. I think there's some stiff competition this year because some teams really, played well above expectation. But he should get plenty of love anyway.
Keith Smith does a great job covering the NBA for Spot Track. He also has the Front Office Show, which we will tell you all about, and he's kind enough to give us some time here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. And Keith, for a guy like me, I've followed him for 35 years, but particularly the last couple of years, it just looks so rewarding for guys like Franz Wagner, Jalen Suggs, Mo Wagner, Wendell Carter. An overwhelming majority of these guys were a part of that 22-win team. And then you add Paolo last year, You bring in some other nice pieces like Joe Ingles, and now 47 wins. I mean, that doesn't happen very often, right? Teams don't improve by 25 wins in 2 years. It's a testament to really what they're building in Central Florida.
It really is. Now, what you do see sometimes is teams do take big jumps forward, but that's usually a team where, hey, we're actually a pretty good team. Like a great example of this will be next year's Memphis Grizzlies, who are a really good team, had a season where the wheels completely came off with Ja Morant's suspension, then a whole bunch of injuries that just, you know, caused them to have a disaster year. They're going to have a great year next year, and people are going to be like, oh, man, the Grizzlies. But you kind of know what happened. With Orlando, it's more that, you know, step-by-step progression of we were bad, we were young, we got a little better, we got a little better, then we started to really pick up steam and move forward. You could see it last year. They were awful the first third of the season. I think they were 5-20 or something in that range and had no healthy guards and just played like a complete mess. Last two-thirds of the season, they played above 500, then closed, you know, playing meaningful games down the stretch into, you know, late March, early April, which was great for them because that helped them boost things this year. So this team has taken those, you know, kind of step progressions year over year, and you feel really good about where the Magic are headed now.
Keith, they get Cleveland in round one in the 4-5. How do you assess that matchup?
Yeah, this is a chance for the Magic to do some damage. Cleveland's a good team. They play pretty tough, but they're not overwhelming. Had Orlando had to match up with Boston, or if they had landed against Milwaukee and Giannis Antetokounmpo was back and healthy and ready to go, those might have been challenging. I think New York would have been somewhat challenging just because of the environment that we're going to see in Madison Square Garden. In Cleveland, you get a team that is, they're good, they're talented, but they're flawed. They are so driven by Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland offensively that if Orlando can just lock in and kind of make life tough on those guys, they're going to have chances to win. Now, Paolo Banchero, he's got his work cut out for him because he's going to draw Evan Mobley, who's a wonderful defender. Backing him up, if he can get by him, is going to be Jared Allen at the rim. Guys for the Magic are going to have to make shots. You know, that's been the question for this team all year long is, who's going to shoot well enough for you to feel really good about where they go, you know, moving forward this year. But this is a chance for them. I think these are probably going to be kind of throwback, ugly physical games where neither team, you know, busts out offensively. But that's great for the Magic. That plays right in their hands if they're going to pull off any kind of upset.
Keith, final thought on Orlando before we branch out a little bit. And I have this mindset. I'm sure the players and the organization don't, but the year was so fun for long-suffering Magic fans like me. Are we at the point where anything else is gravy? I mean, they're the 5 seed. They were projected to be the 9 or the 10. They won 47 games. I mean, even if they get swept, that would be disappointing. But is everything else gravy at this point, or do you think you shouldn't think of it like that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. They're not going to have that mindset, right? And they shouldn't. They should go in expecting to win and be competitive. Otherwise, you know, the way coaches will always frame that is, what are we playing for, right? If we don't think we can win, we should just call it a year, pack up, and everybody go home. So they're going to have a different mindset. But I think to some extent that is true. I think if they go in, fall on their face, get swept in embarrassing fashion, and they're getting blown out in 4 games, that's a disappointment, right? Because it should have been better than that. They should have been more competitive. But if they step into this series, you know, with the Cavs and they're competitive and they're challenging them, and they're pushing Cleveland, then even if they lose, you can look at it and say, hey, this is what expected. In a lot of ways, it's funny that it's the Cavs because they're kind of this year's Cavs. Like the Cavs were this team a year ago where it was they'd made their step forward, then they actually get in the playoffs. They got bounced out. The Knicks took care of them fairly easily. But the Cavs were, you know, they kind of learned, all right, this is what you got to do in the postseason. That's where Orlando's at now. So gravy, yes, as long as you're at least competitive in these games.
A couple of more for Keith Smith of SpotTrack and the Front Office Show here with us on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Keith, the Eastern Conference as a whole, boy, the Knicks battled and clawed and got the number 2 seed. And I'm sitting there watching it yesterday thinking, all right, that's interesting because their reward is either going to be Philadelphia or Miami. We'll find out Wednesday during that play-in game Who do the Knicks want to see more, the Sixers or the Heat?
I think they'd probably rather see the Heat, but that's very dependent on what does Joel Embiid look like. If we're going to get a Joel Embiid that's going to be out there limping up and down the floor and barely able to finish games, then you'd rather get the Sixers because they become a far easier team to play. But if Embiid, you know, with a couple of days off here, he hasn't played since Friday, if he's really ready to go and it looks like, all right, this guy's going to be okay, then you'd rather get the Heat. The Heat are just a far more limited team. They don't have as much they can go to offensively. You can kind of get into games where you can kind of shut them down a little bit, make it harder on them to score, and that gives you a better chance to win. Where if it's Philly, you know you're going to have to deal with Embiid's going to score his 30. He's probably going to take 10 to 15 free throws a game, and the next thing you know, now half your front court's in foul trouble and guys are banged up and all that stuff. So I think they'd rather have the Heat unless Embiid's banged up than give me Philly.
Who's Boston's biggest challenger in the Eastern Conference?
Interestingly enough, it could be, you know, Philly or Miami in that first round, just with the history there. I think Celtics feel pretty good about Philadelphia, as Joel Embiid has said very famously. It's not a rivalry because they beat us every time. So that's how he feels. And I think Celtics, if you can pour truth serum into them, they tell you the same thing. Now, on the flip side, I think with Miami, Miami's going to feel very confident if they have to go into Boston because they've been there, done that a couple times over the last few years. So I think that's, you know, a challenge there. And then it's obviously if the Bucks can get Giannis back, if they can get through the first round and then Giannis is Giannis again and ready to go beyond that, they're the biggest challenger to Boston just because the amount of talent that team has. But I think the Celtics are in a position where they should almost be looking at it as, doesn't matter who we play, we're the best team in the league, never mind the conference. And if we don't get all the way through the finals, this season was not the season we thought it was supposed to be.
Final moments with Keith Smith of Spot Track and the Front Office Show. Tomorrow night's going to be really interesting in New Orleans because the winner of that game between the Lakers and the Pelicans draws Denver, where the loser would have to play in an elimination game on Friday, but they would then have a chance to play Oklahoma City in round one. Do either the Lakers or the Pelicans want to win that game tomorrow night?
Yeah, they both do. You do not. There is no world where you throw a game in the play-in tournament and go into that second game, because in that second game, you're facing a Kings team that can score points by the bundle, and, or you're facing the Warriors and Stephen Curry. And can you imagine if you're the Lakers and you throw that game, then you go into the second game and Stephen Curry has a night where he scores 55, 60 points, beat you all by yourself, and now your season's just over. You'd never recover from that as far as people are going to get fired. There would be, you know, organizational changes up and down. It's the same thing where people start to get, well, this team might be better off being in the play-in tournament. Every coach and every front office person has said over and over and over again, even ones that aren't even close and not even involved in them making that decision, we don't want any part of the play-in tournament, never mind losing in it, because you're just putting yourself in a spot where, hey, you know, what if you lose a game and your star player rolls his ankle? Because you kind of threw away the game, and now you're going into a second game without him. Now you're in a spot where your season could be over. So no one's going to ever throw a playoff game. Now, you could be in a world where if you're the Pelicans or Lakers and you're down, like it was yesterday, Pelicans were down 20, 30 points in the fourth quarter. Yeah, you might say, forget it. Let's just live to fight another day. But going into the game, you're trying to win those play-in games.
Yeah, crazy. The Kings and the Warriors, who had a crazy series last year, are now going to have an elimination game basically tomorrow night where the winter season continues and the loser season will be over. Keith, as we wrap up, the top of the West, Oklahoma City gets the 1, Denver the 2, Minnesota the 3. I have a buddy that's a Timberwolf fan, and he was all distraught last night. He doesn't think they have a prayer of beating Phoenix, even though they have home court in that series. How dangerous is Phoenix, and are they the biggest challenger to Denver in the West?
They may be. I think Minnesota didn't do themselves any favor. They could have, you know, if they had played better and won that game, they would have pushed Phoenix into the play-in tournament, and Minnesota would have been still in the same spot seeding-wise, but they would have played the Pelicans, who I think they match up far better with. The challenge with Phoenix for the Timberwolves is Phoenix loves to live in the mid-range. They'll shoot Kevin Durant pull-ups and Devin Booker pull-ups and Bradley Beal pull-up jumpers more than any other team in the league, and that's what Minnesota's entire defensive scheme is designed around. We're going to give you those shots. So it's really going to be, can Minnesota take advantage of their size on offense to score enough points to put enough pressure on Phoenix? Because if Phoenix gets going, there's really, despite the fact that the Wolves are one of the best defensive teams in the entire league, and you could argue the best defensive team, they're just not a great matchup with the Suns, and that's going to be really, really hard for them.
Keith, final question. Denver and Boston, is it that simple, or will it be more complicated?
I think it's going to be one of those things where it feels a lot more complicated over the next couple of months as we watch it play out, and then that's where we're going to land anyway, which is where I think we're all expecting to be. I think Boston's been the best team in the league. I trust Denver the most of any team in the Western Conference. I don't think they pushed overly hard throughout the course of the regular season. I think they're at the point in their arc as a team of, we just got to get into the playoffs with a pretty good seed, and we'll let the rest take care of itself. It's far more important that we're healthy. Then we go from there, and I think that's where we're at with the Nuggets, that they're just going to kind of do their thing as we get there, and that's going to be, you know, how this plays out.
Keith, tell the good folks here in Jacksonville about the front office show and where they can find it.
Yeah, you can watch us every day, Monday through Friday. Every Friday is a live show. Monday through Thursday, recorded shows, NBA front office show. Find it over on YouTube. My co-host Trevor Lane and I, we break down all things NBA. Obviously, this week we'll be very focused on the play-in tournament and then the resulting playoff matchup. We'll also go through our picks for the NBA awards this week. And then as the offseason gets into, we'll discuss all of the offseason stuff. We do live shows for the NBA draft and throughout free agency, where we break down everything that happens. But every day, Monday through Friday, NBA front office show, either on YouTube or you can find us, you know, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast provider, whether it be Apple, Spotify, whatever it may be.
Absolutely love it. Keith, I tell you this every time you're on, you do a great job covering the NBA. You're an awesome follow on social media, and we certainly appreciate it. Keith Smith, front office show and Spot Track. Thank you as always, my friend.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
This is Hacker After Dark on 1010XL.
Yes, it is. With you till 10 o'clock tonight, 1010XL, 92.5 FM. We are 10 days away, 10 evenings away from the NFL draft next Thursday night up in Detroit. Of course, the Jaguars own the 17th pick in round number one. They got 5 picks in the top 116, 8 picks total. Trent Baalke's done a good job in round one. He has not done a good job in rounds 2, 3, and 4. That needs to change. Those 5 picks in the top 116, you got to find some players, particularly in rounds 2 and 3 this year. We're going to do a lot of draft, as you would imagine, over the next 10 nights. We'll begin with Ryan Roberts, Rise in Draft. The letter N, riseindraft.com. We've had Ryan on for years. Let's talk wide receivers. Let's talk defensive backs. And let's talk about the Jaguars and their needs heading into next week and the NFL draft. As a Monday night edition of Hacker After Dark rolls on with Dylan Denmark, the hacker Ryan Green with you right here on 1010XL and on 92.5 FM. Back here on 1010XL and 92.5 FM in the city of Jacksonville, we are glad you are with us. The NFL draft, 2 weeks from Thursday night. Of course, the Jaguars hold the 17th pick in round number one. They have 5 selections in the top 116. Those 5 guys need to hit. Trent Baalke's got to do a better job in rounds 2, 3, and 4 this upcoming draft. With that being said, Ryan Roberts is certainly one of our guys and has been for years here on 1010XL. Rise and Draft is where you can follow him on the website and on social media. And Ryan's always kind enough to give us some time here on 1010XL. Ryan, how you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good. It's the best time of the year. The work's all done. We're just kind of sitting back and letting people freak out about rumors and, you know, and just kind of some bad information that's out there right now. You know, it's kind of the guessing game this time of year. So it's always fun. It's always fun when the work's done. You just kind of get to relax a little bit.
And it's interesting you say that, and we're going to dive into the Jags, but I'm curious. The draft is 2 weeks from Thursday. If the NFL said, nope, we're drafting tonight, drop everything, go into your war room, we're drafting right now, could teams do that? Are they ready?
I mean, the Chicago Bears are, I would say, right? Because, I mean, they have a little bit of time, you know, between picks, so they got to figure it out. But, I mean, for the most part, cross checks are pretty much at this point all finalized and everything. I mean, this is really where the board gets stacked, you know, and you really kind of get that more kind of the vertical board and kind of what things look like. I mean, it's a lot more attentive than kind of people paint it as, right? Like, at the end of the day, teams aren't building a top 350 board like some websites are doing. They're building a much more finite, really specific board because they have, at this point, have all the information they need from, obviously, the player evals, the cross checks, and all that stuff are all done. But they've been digging into these players. They've been talking to them. They're bringing them in for 30 visits. They've been having Zoom calls. They have all the information. So I think for the most part, they have all the information they need. These last couple weeks are just more about finalizing thoughts, finalizing boards, and making sure they're comfortable about where they're at.
Ryan Roberts, riseanddraft.com. All right, Ryan, you and I haven't spoken since free agency, and the Jaguars were one of the most active teams in free agency. They brought in a lot of guys. They had some guys leave, obviously, Calvin Ridley among them. But when you look at what the Jaguars have accomplished so far with the guys they brought in, how do you feel that affects what they're going to do in a couple of weeks at the draft?
I mean, it kind of just finalizes my thoughts, to be honest. I mean, I think two of the most important positions that we've spoken about, you know, kind of recently is wide receiver and corner. And I think that when you talk about just kind of the movement in free agency and defections in free agency, I think it just kind of finalized everything for me. You know, in my mind, it's like, you know, what are they going to do at pick 17? As it currently stands, I would be kind of surprised if it wasn't a wide receiver or corner. You know, you lose Calvin Ridley. I know they brought in, you know, I know they brought in, what's his name from Buffalo, Gabe Davis, you know, kind of be a little bit of a fixture in there, hopefully, and kind of reignite what Buffalo saw him early on in his career coming out of UCF. But I think right now, wide receiver is obviously a massive need. Darius Williams went back to the Rams in free agency, who I know was a pretty solid player for the most part for Jacksonville. So cornerback, wide receiver, it just kind of finalized like first round mock draft. That's the two positions that I'm forecasting for Jacksonville leading up into the big day.
And it's interesting, too, because I know the last time you and I talked, we were talking about Jackson Powers Johnson and the interior offensive line, but then they go out and sign Mitch Morse, they re-sign Ezra Cleveland, and now no one's really talking about the interior offensive line. That's what free agency can do. All right, you mentioned wide receiver and corner. Let's begin with corner. Now, Doug Peterson made a little bit of news a couple of weeks ago. We thought Darnell Savage, the free agent from Green Bay, was going to be the Rayshon Jenkins replacement at safety. Apparently, that's not the way the Jaguars see it. The Jaguars are going to use him more as the nickel, so that means your top three corners now are Tyson Campbell, Ronald Darby, and Darnell Savage, with Antonio Johnson replacing Rayshon Jenkins at safety. Do you believe the Jaguars at those top three corner spots, Savage, Darby, Campbell, do they need to go corner at 17, in your opinion? Is that their biggest need?
I think that it's between wide receiver and corner, like I said. Like, if they chose to take a corner at 17, I would be completely fine with it. I would actually welcome it. I think that Tyson Campbell, I know he was a little banged up this past year. It was a little bit of a regression year, just kind of overall. But he still has, obviously, all the tools to be that type of guy for Jacksonville. I know he's played pretty well for the most part throughout the duration of his early career so far. So I think you're good with Campbell. Ronald Darby, I mean, he's been on several teams at this point. Like, he's just a stopgap at this point, right? Like, he's not a guy that you're depending upon long-term or probably even at a high volume short-term. Like, he's just kind of that guy that is going to allow you to at least have a competent name in the room. And Darnell Savage, like, we'll see, you know, like, it's a wait and see conversation for me because Darnell has played mostly on the roof, you know, for Green Bay. Like, he was mostly a true safety. I know when he was at Maryland coming out, he did play a little bit of slot corner. So, I mean, I guess it makes sense that he's kind of dabbling in both areas. And obviously he's a very gifted athlete. There's no doubt about that. So maybe you can get the best out of him. But I think overall there is still a massive need at outside corner. And if they opt for a guy like a Quinyon Mitchell, if he's there at 17, or Nate Wiggins, or a Tyrion Arnold from Alabama, you know, whoever it ends up being, I think that that would be a very good pick because I do think that that is one of their top two needs, cornerback and wide receiver.
Ryan Roberts, riseanddraft.com. That's rise, the letter N, draft.com. All right, Ryan, from corner, you mentioned Quinyon Mitchell, Tyrion Arnold of Alabama. Those appear to be the top two. And in most mock drafts, not all, but most, Mitchell and Arnold are gone before 17. Let's hypothetically say that's the case on the 25th of April. If Mitchell and Arnold are gone, who is your third guy or who is the best fit remaining for the Jaguars at corner at 17?
Yeah, I mean, so for me at corner, I think at 17, Nate Wiggins would be a guy out of Clemson that I would be very excited about, because I think that he brings – because I think the conversation is going to be there, in my opinion, Ryan, is like there's going to be three guys that people are going to talk about if they're talking corner at 17. One is going to be Nate Wiggins, who I just mentioned out of Clemson, who's a long, athletic, can run for days, incredibly twitched up, short area quickness guy. You have Cooper DeJean out of Iowa, who's kind of a jack of all trades, like can kind of play all over the place, but he is a little bit scheme specific outside. Like he's more of a zone heavy type of corner, you know, in comparative to like what a Nate Wiggins is like a true man corner. And then you're going to talk about Kool-Aid McKinstry. Now it's a great out of Alabama, and it's a great conversation because Kool-Aid is, out of the three of them, by far the most steady and consistent playing press man. Like that is what he majors in, that like he is a very good press man corner. Other systems, you know, he's maybe not, at least coverage variations, like he's not quite as effective. I would personally offer Nate Wiggins, because although if Jacksonville, let's say, and I don't know as much about the scheme obviously as you do, but you know, if they're playing a ton of press man, for instance, right, I think that a lot of people would gravitate towards Kool-Aid. But I would argue that in the day and age of how the NFL is in 2024, you're not playing one just coverage variation all day. Like you need to be a little bit of a versatile piece on the back end, and I think Nate Wiggins could do everything. Like the major thing about Nate is he needs to gain some weight and play strength, but that stuff I can fix that, right? Like it's an off season in a strength and conditioning program in the NFL. I can't teach 4.28 speed. I can't teach length. I can't teach just the ability to change direction that this young man has. So I look at him and I say, he could definitely play press man as his play strength improves. He's got the length. He's got the reach. He can play off man today in the NFL, and he can play zone. Like he can do everything. So for me, at 17, if that's my pick between the three, I would opt for Nate Wiggins, because I think whether you are a heavy press man team, you're an off man team, you're a zone team, you're a zone match team, like whatever coverage you kind of lie to mostly, I think that he can present the highest upside to play any of them.
Ryan Roberts, riseanddraft.com. Now that's the cornerback situation. We focus on that in a moment. Now let's go to wide receiver. The top three wide receivers in the Jaguar room right now: Christian Kirk, Gabe Davis, Zay Jones. Obviously, with the departure of Ridley, Parker Washington is here. And people don't really talk about it, and I'm guilty of that as well. Devin Duvernay is a much more accomplished wide receiver than Jamal Agnew was. Agnew was a DB that transitioned to wide receiver. Well, Duvernay is an all-pro returner that is a true wide receiver. So I don't think people need to forget that Duvernay is here as well. Having said that, how big is wide receiver for the Jaguars, Ryan? And at 17, the two names that we hear constantly, Brian Thomas Jr., A.D. Mitchell, how do you assess those two?
I think they're exactly, at least from a physical skill set perspective, I think that both Brian Thomas, and I do prefer Brian Thomas compared to A.D. Mitchell. I do actually have some concerns about A.D. But regardless, they're what Jacksonville needs at wide receiver if we're bringing in a wide receiver at 17. Because I look at the depth chart and I say there's a lot of good secondary pass catchers. There's a lot of guys that I think could also feast in the slot. They could be short to intermediate separators. I mean, you know, you mentioned Devin Duvernay, who's a short space type of guy. He's got long speed, but like for the most part, he's an underneath separator, a guy that's going to win after the catch. You mentioned Parker Washington. He's kind of got the similar style. Zay Jones is not a fast guy, but he's a little bit of an inside-out guy that can run routes and kind of create some separation. And then Christian Kirk is, again, that short-to-intermediate separator that can make some things happen after the catch, you know, when he gets an opportunity. So I think that for the most part, the only guy vertically oriented that is on Jacksonville's roster right now, at least from an outside perspective, is Gabe Davis. And Gabe Davis is a very inconsistent wide receiver, which we saw with Buffalo the last 2 years. So I think you need to find some length outside. I think you need to find some vertical ability outside. And when you talk about Brian Thomas Jr. and A.D. Mitchell at both 6'2 plus with length for days and 4.3 speed, that is the dynamic that you need to bring to Jacksonville if you're going to take him at 17.
Ryan, the talk between corner and wide receiver, and look, I've had a lot of guys on. I certainly value your opinion. That's why we have you on every single year, so I want to ask you directly. I've been told that, all right, if you need a corner, you need a wide receiver, maybe take corner at 17 because wide receiver's deeper, and you might be able to find a good player at 48 in round number two. Do you agree with that?
Right. I actually don't agree with that. I think that So in a vacuum, do I agree that you could find a good wide receiver 48? Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's an opportunity to maybe get a, you know, Keon Coleman's fallen a little bit out of Florida State. He's kind of an outside-oriented receiver. You have Ladd McConkey, who's a little bit more of like the former that I was talking about, of like the short to intermediate separators with some speed. Like, you can find a good player at 48, but I don't know if you're going to find the right type of receiver for, again, what I think Jacksonville needs. You know, like those guys that are tall, long, and explosive outside, those guys get picked early, right? They get picked super early. So I actually think that you might have a better opportunity, in my opinion, to get a good corner at 48, you know, like whether that is a TJ Tampa out of Iowa State or a Cam Hart out of Notre Dame. Like, I still think that there's it's a pretty deep corner class as well. And I would argue, though, that the dynamic that Jacksonville needs, those types of players get picked early, man. They come off the board very quickly. And I don't know if you're going to find 6'3 with 4'3 speed at pick 48. I think if you want a difference maker with an outside skill set, I think that should be the pick at 17. Like, for me personally, if Brian Thomas Jr. is there, that's probably my pick. Like, it straight up is, because I think that kid has every variable, every tangible skill set to be a difference maker at the next level. Think DJ Chark with much more physicality and consistency, keep tracking the ball down the field. Like, that's what I see in a guy like Brian Thomas. So I would actually prefer the wide receiver, outside-oriented, big playability at 17, and then find the best possible corner that you can at 48, because I still think the cornerback also has a lot of depth to the class.
You said you had some concerns about A.D. Mitchell. What are some of your concerns?
Yeah. I mean, one, and this is a very nuanced conversation, because I very much oppose anybody that just scouts a box score, right? Like, that is, I'm a film guy, always have been. I'm not a huge analytics guy, and I'm definitely not a box score scouter. But ultimately, a guy that talented, a guy that is 6'2 plus, a guy that is long, a guy that is super explosive, former high caliber recruit that started his career at Georgia. Very simply, why weren't you more productive, man? He had 8 games last year where he had below 50 yards receiving at Texas with a lot of weapons, where he was getting a lot of one-on-one matchups with a passing savant offensive coordinator in Steve Sarkisian, obviously his head coach. Like, why were you not more productive? You know, it gives me the vibes of, I don't know if you ever see Moneyball, but like when Brad Pitt says, like, if he's such a good hitter, why doesn't he hit good? Right. Yeah, like, and that's what I'm thinking with Brian Thomas. It's like, this kid's so physically gifted. He looks like $1 million. You watch him just run around, and you're like, why isn't that kid more dominant than he is right now? Why isn't he more productive? And then I'm watching the film, and I have some concerns over a little bit lackadaisical at times, a little bit of loafing on the backside of plays, like doesn't seem to run everything out. And then I think the play strength still needs to take a step forward. Like, I don't think he wins consistently through contact, especially like in the last game of the season, you know, where you're watching him. And it's just like, you know, just he has a chance to make a couple plays. And I just don't think that he's matched the physicality as much down the course of the stretch against Washington, and, you know, in his final game of the season. So play strength and just kind of lackadaisicalness and lack of production, like those things together kind of give me some pause, because that kid physically is about as impressive a wide receiver prospect that we've seen over the last couple of years, at least just from a height, weight, speed perspective. So why aren't you better? Why haven't you dominated more? The lack of production and consistency does give me a lot of pause.
Final moments, Ryan Roberts, RiseAndDraft.com. I agree with you about Brian Thomas. If he's there, that's probably where I'm going, with one caveat, and I've been on this for the last couple of weeks. I didn't think there was a chance that Jared Verse would be there at 17. And quite frankly, I still don't. But as these mock drafts come out, Ryan, the more mock drafts that come out, Jared Verse is there about half the time. And I got to tell you, man, if Verse is there at 17 on April 25th, and I have the idea of Trayvon Walker, Josh Allen, Eric Armstead, and Jared Verse on my D-line, that would be awfully, awfully tempting for me.
Well, I would say this about the Verse conversation. Verse is my top-ranked edge in this class. I think he's a top-10 overall player. I think he's the most underrated prospect maybe in this class overall. Like, people never mock him there, you know? Like you're saying, like, there's a lot more mock drafts that have him closer to 20 than they do the 10 at this point. Like, it happens. And I think that what we're seeing is, one, we're overthinking Jared Verse a little bit. I mean, that kid's an elite-level athlete. Is he the bendiest guy of all time? No, but the speed, the power is real. The production is real. And that kid just has a lot of upside, man. I mean, we forget about him that he's only been playing Power Five football for 2 years. You know, like he was at Albany before that. And before that, he was a very underrated recruit and a guy that apparently played defense in high school. So there's still a lot of untapped potential with Jared Verse. I think that the trouble with this class and why he seems to be falling in mock drafts specifically is because, one, it's a very offensive heavy draft. You know, in that first 10 picks, like there's a possibility that all top 10 picks are offensive players. I mean, you have a heavy class of quarterbacks at the top, wide receivers, offensive tackles. Like, it is a silly year to need those positions. Like, it is incredible depth at each one of those spots. So I think that some defensive players are naturally just getting pushed down the board a little bit. And then the conversation comes to Dallas Turner, Alabama, more of a stand-up, twitchier rusher, a little bit of a, you know, lighter build. You have Jared Verse. You have Laiatu Latu out of UCLA, who's a little bit more of the technician, maybe not as powerful, maybe not as bendy as Dallas Turner, but kind of a good blend overall. Like, what do you prefer? If Dallas Turner goes off the board first, I think that one of those two could slide potentially and move down a little board, move down the board a little bit. And then you could be in the situation where if one team likes Laiatu Latu and his neck injury from the past checks out, then maybe Jared Verse ends up being the third edge off the board. So I think it really depends on what the edge hierarchy looks like, but you might be tasked with that difficult decision, man, because on paper, Jacksonville doesn't have a major need on the edge. Like you said, like you got some dudes, you know, and Trayvon Walker took a nice step forward, and Josh Allen is a potential superstar, you know, after the season that he just had. I know his long-term future, you still need to figure out the contract and everything, but overall, it's not a massive need on paper. But Jared Verse might be the player that makes you second guess or at least think about it, because he at pick number 17 would be a tremendous value in this draft, obviously.
Great minds think alike, and apparently you and I do as well. That's my guy if he's there. If he's not there, I'm on board with Brian Thomas, because you got to help Trevor Lawrence, no question about that. Ryan Roberts, Rise in Draft. You can follow him on social media, Rise, the letter N, Draft. You can also check out the website. Ryan, I know you're busy, man. Thank you as always. Let's do it again after the draft, and we'll see where the dust settles when it comes to the Jaguars.
Absolutely, brother. Thank you as always for having me. It's very appreciated.
And thank you to Ryan Roberts, Rise in Draft, the letter N, riseindraft.com, for joining us tonight here on Hacker After Dark, as we are now within what? Less than 10 days, right? 10 days from tonight. And by this time next Thursday, the Jaguars will have likely already made their selection at number 17. Of course, they have 8 picks total. 5 picks in the top 116, and all the talk has been wide receiver or DB, DB or wide receiver. I thought John Shipley of Jaguar Report brought up some good points earlier today. I wouldn't discount offensive tackle, and as you guys know, I've been all in on Jared Verse if he's there. If Jared Verse is there next Thursday night at pick 17 when the Jaguars are on the clock, to me, it's an absolute no-brainer. I would take that guy in a heartbeat. So we will certainly see what happens. But all the talk about Quinyon Mitchell and Terrion Arnold at corner, A.D. Mitchell and Brian Thomas Jr. at wide receiver, those seem to be the four guys that most people are talking about. Yet why is it when the Jaguars are picking around this time of the draft, mid to late round, the guys that we've spent so much time on in the pre-draft process never actually turn out to be the pick? And as we get closer to the draft, I'm starting to have that feeling that that may happen again here in 2024. We'll see. We'll talk about it certainly the next week and a half leading up to next Thursday night up in Detroit with the National Football League draft. Well, that'll just about do it. It has been a very, very busy Monday night edition of Hacker After Dark, as they all are normally this time of year. We certainly appreciate you guys hanging out with us here on 1010XL and on 92.5 FM. We have a ton of people to thank. Again, Ryan Roberts, Rise in Draft, the letter N, riseindraft.com, for joining us. Thank you to Keith Smith of Spot Track and the Front Office Show, talking NBA as the NBA playoffs really begin tomorrow night. You got the two Western Conference play-in games tomorrow. What's interesting there, the winner of Lakers and Pelicans get the defending world champion Nuggets in round one. You're not going to throw a game, but man alive, who wants to win that to get Denver in round one? The loser of that game tomorrow night gets the winner of Golden State Sacramento in a winner-go-home scenario on Friday. And if you win that game, you then get Oklahoma City. I rather play Oklahoma City than Denver. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how both the Lakers and the Pelicans play that tomorrow. The Eastern Conference play-in is on Wednesday. Really good matchup, Miami and Philadelphia. The winner of that game gets the New York Knicks in round one. The loser will play the winner of Atlanta and Chicago. And then whoever wins that game on Friday has to deal with the Boston Celtics in round one. But certainly with Keith Smith, we talked a lot about the Orlando Magic as well. 4-year absence from the NBA playoffs is no more. The Magic, Southeast Division champions. They are the 5 seed in round number one, and they will play Cleveland. Game one, Eastern Conference first round up in Cleveland on Saturday afternoon. And in back in hour number one, John Shipley, as I mentioned, of Jaguar Report. Always appreciate John joining us as the Jaguar offseason program began today. 99 days after the season ended in Nashville, the voluntary portion of the Jaguar offseason program did begin today. It was good to see the fellas back. They'll meet the media tomorrow, and the pre-draft luncheon with Doug Peterson and Trent Baalke is on Thursday. I'll be down there for that. Certainly looking forward to that. We will be back tomorrow night on a Tuesday, in for Blue tomorrow, so we'll be on at 6 o'clock from 6 to 8 tomorrow here on Hacker After Dark. Dylan Denmark was your producer tonight. Dylan, great job as always. I'm the Hacker, Ryan Green. And again, Jacksonville, thank you for spending part of your Monday evening with us right here on Hacker After Dark on 1010XL and on 92.5 FM. So for all of us here on HAD, have an absolutely terrific remainder of your Monday evening, and we will do it all over again tomorrow night on a Tuesday, beginning at 6 o'clock. Until then, good night, Jacksonville.